This is Audible.
Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents The Testament by John Grisham. Chapter 1. Down to the last day. Even the last hour now. I'm an old man, lonely and unloved, sick and hurting and tired of living. I am ready for the hereafter. It has to be better than this. I own the tall glass building in which I sit, and 97% of the company housed in it below me, and the land around it half a mile in three directions, and the 2,000 people who work here and the other 20,000 who do not. And I own the pipeline under the land that brings gas to the building from my fields in Texas, and I own the utility lines that deliver electricity, and I lease the satellite unseen miles above by which I once barked commands to my empire flung far around the world. My assets exceed $11 billion. I own silver in Nevada, and copper in Montana, and coffee in Kenya, and coal in Angola, and rubber in Malaysia, and natural gas in Texas, and crude oil in Indonesia, and steel in China. My company owns companies that produce electricity, and make computers, and build dams, and print paperbacks, and broadcast signals to my satellite. I have subsidiaries with divisions in more countries than anyone can find. I once owned all the appropriate toys, the yachts and jets and blondes, homes in Europe, farms in Argentina, an island in the Pacific, thoroughbreds, even a hockey team. But I've grown too old for toys. The money is the root of my misery. I had three families, three ex-wives who bore seven children, six of whom are still alive and doing all they can to torment me. To the best of my knowledge, I fathered all seven and buried one. I should say his mother buried him. I was out of the country. I am estranged from all the wives and all the children. They're gathering here today, because I'm dying, and it's time to divide the money. I have planned this day for a long time. My building has 14 floors, all long and wide and squared around a shaded courtyard in the rear where I once held lunches in the sunshine. I live and work on the top floor, 12,000 square feet of opulence that would seem obscene to many but doesn't bother me in the least. By sweat and brains and luck, I built every dime of my fortune. Spending it is my prerogative. Giving it away should be my choice, too. But I'm being hounded. Why should I care who gets the money? I've done everything imaginable with it. As I sit here in my wheelchair alone and waiting, I cannot think of a single thing I want to buy or see or a single place I want to go or another adventure I want to pursue. I've done it all, and I'm very tired. I don't care who gets the money. But I do care very much who does not get it. Every square foot of this building was designed by me, and so I know exactly where to place everyone for this little ceremony. They're all here, waiting and waiting, though they don't mind. They'd stand naked in a blizzard for what I'm about to do. The first family is Lillian and her brood. Four of my offspring born to a woman who rarely let me touch her. We married young, I was 24 and she was 18, and so Lillian is old, too. I haven't seen her in years, and I won't see her today. I'm sure she's still playing the role of the grieving, abandoned, yet dutiful first wife who got traded in for a trophy. She has never remarried, and I'm sure she hasn't had sex in 50 years. I don't know how we reproduced. Her oldest is now 47, Troy Jr., a worthless idiot who is cursed with my name. As a boy, he adopted the nickname of TJ and still prefers it to Troy. Of the 6 children gathered here now, TJ is the dumbest, though it's close. He was tossed from college when he was 19 for selling drugs. TJ, like the rest, was given $5 million on his 21st birthday, and like the rest, it ran like water through his fingers. I cannot bear to recount the miserable histories of Lillian's children. Suffice to say, they're all heavily in debt and virtually unemployable, with little hope of changing. So my signing of this will is the most critical event in their lives. Back to the ex-wives. From the frigidity of Lillian, I ran to the steamy passion of Janie, a beautiful young thing hired as a secretary in accounting, but promoted rapidly when I decided I needed her on business trips. I divorced Lillian and married Janie, who was 22 years younger than I was and determined to keep me satisfied. She had 2 children as fast as she could. She used them as anchors to keep me close. Rocky, the younger, was killed in a sports car with 2 of his buddies in a wreck that cost me $6 million to settle out of court. I married Tyra when I was 64. She was 23 and pregnant by me with a little monster she named Ramble, for some reason that was never clear to me. Ramble is now 14 and already has 1 arrest for shoplifting and 1 arrest for possession of marijuana. His oily hair sticks to his neck and falls way down his back, and he adorns himself with rings in his ears, eyebrows, and nose. I'm told he goes to school when he feels like it. Ramble is ashamed that his father is almost 80, and his father is ashamed that his son has silver beads pierced through his tongue. And he, along with the rest of them, expects me to sign my name on this will and make his life better. As large as my fortune is, the money won't last long among these fools. A dying old man should not hate, but I cannot help it. They are a miserable bunch, all of them. Their mothers hate me, so the children in turn have been taught to hate me, too. They are vultures, circling with clawed feet, sharp teeth, and hungry eyes, giddy with the anticipation of unlimited cash. The soundness of my mind is of great issue now. They think I have a tumor because I say weird things. I babble on incoherently in meetings and on the phone, and behind my back my aides whisper and nod and think to themselves, yes, it's true, it's the tumor. I made a will 2 years ago and left everything to the last live-in, who at the time paraded around my apartment in leopard print panties and nothing else. And yes, I guess I'm crazy about 20-year-old blondes with all the curves. But she later got the boot. The shredder got the will. I simply got tired. 3 years ago, I made a will just for the hell of it and left everything to charities. Over 100 of them. I was cursing TJ one day, and he was cursing me, and I told him about this new will. He and his mother and his siblings hired a bunch of crooked lawyers and ran to court in an attempt to have me committed to an institution for treatment and evaluation. This was actually smart on the part of their lawyers, because if I'd been judged mentally incompetent, my will would have been void. But I have many lawyers, and I pay them $1,000 an hour to manipulate the legal system in my favor. I was not committed, though at the time I was probably a bit off my rocker. And I have my own shredder, one I've used for all the old wills. They're all gone, eaten by a little machine. I wear long white robes made of Thai silk, and I shave my head like a monk, and I eat little so that my body is small and shriveled. They think I'm a Buddhist, but in reality I study Zoroaster. They don't know the difference. I can almost understand why they think my mental capacity has diminished. Lillian and the First Family are in the executive conference room on the 13th floor, just below me. It's a large room, marble and mahogany, with rich rugs and a long oval table down the center, and it's now filled with very nervous people. Not surprisingly, there are more lawyers than family members. Lillian has a lawyer, and so does each of her four children, except for TJ, who has brought along three to show his importance and make certain all scenarios are properly counseled. TJ has more legal problems than most death row inmates. At one end of the table is a large digital screen which will broadcast the proceedings. TJ's brother is Rex, age 44, my second son, currently married to a stripper. Amber is her name, a poor creature without a brain but with a large fake chest, who I think is his third wife. Second or third. But who am I to condemn? She's here, along with the rest of the current spouses and/or live-ins, fidgeting nervously as $11 billion is about to be divided. Lillian's first daughter, my oldest, is Libigail, a child I loved desperately, until she left for college and forgot about me. Then she married an African, and I erased her name from my wills. Mary Ross was the last child born to Lillian. She's married to a doctor who aspires to be super rich, but they are heavily in debt. Janie and the second family wait in a room on the 10th floor. Janie has had two husbands since our divorce many years ago. I'm almost certain she is living alone at the moment. I hire investigators to keep me posted, but not even the FBI could keep track of her bed-hopping. As I mentioned, Rocky, her son, was killed. Her daughter, Gina, is here with her second husband, a moron with an MBA who is just dangerous enough to take a half a billion or so and masterfully lose it in 3 years. And then there's Rambo slouching in a chair on the 5th floor, licking the gold ring in the corner of his lip, fingering his sticky green hair, scowling at his mother, who had the gall to appear here today with a hairy little gigolo. Rambo expects to get rich today, to be handed a fortune simply because he was sired by me. And Ramble has a lawyer, too, a hippie radical sort Tyra saw on television and hired right after she laid him. They're waiting along with the rest. I know these people. I watch them. Sneed appears from the rear of my apartment. He's been my gopher for almost 30 years now. A round, homely little man in a white waistcoat, meek and humble, perpetually bent at the waist as if bowing to the king. Sneed stops before me, hands clasped at the belly, as always, head cocked to one side, drippy smile, and says, "How are you, sir?" in an affected lilt he acquired years back when we were staying in Ireland. I say nothing, because I'm neither required nor expected to respond to Sneed. "Some coffee, sir?" "Lunch." Sneed winks with both eyes and bows even deeper, then waddles from the room, his trouser cuffs dragging the floor. He, too, expects to be made rich when I die, and I suppose he's counting the days like the rest of them. The trouble with having money is that everybody wants a little of it, just a slice, a small sliver. What's $1 million to a man with billions? Give me $1 million, old boy, and you'll never know the difference. Float me alone, and we'll both forget about it. Wedge my name in the will somewhere. There's room for it. Sneed's nosy as hell, and years ago I caught him picking through my desk, looking, I think, for the current will. He wants me to die because he expects a few million. What right does he have to expect anything? I should have fired him years ago. His name is not mentioned in my new will. He sits a tray before me, an unopened tube of Ritz crackers, a small jar of honey with the plastic seal around the lid, and a 12-ounce can of Fresca, room temperature. Any variation in Sneed would be fired on the spot. I dismiss him and dip the crackers in the honey. The final meal. Chapter 2. I sit and stare through the tinted glass walls. On a clear day, I can see the top of the Washington Monument 6 miles away. But not today. Today is raw and cold, windy and overcast. Not a bad day to die. The wind blows the last of the leaves from their branches and scatters them through the parking lot below. Why am I worried about the pain? What's wrong with a little suffering? I've caused more misery than any 10 people. I push a button and Sneed appears. He bows and pushes my wheelchair through the door of my apartment into the marble foyer, down the marble hall, through another door. We're getting closer, but I feel no anxiety. I've kept the shrinks waiting for over 2 hours. We pass my office, and I nod at Nicolette, my latest secretary, a darling young thing I'm quite fond of. Given some time, she might have become number 4. But there is no time. Only minutes. A mob is waiting. Packs of lawyers and some psychiatrists who'll determine if I'm in my right mind. They are crowded around a long table in my conference room, and when I enter, their conversation stops immediately and everybody stares. Sneed situates me on one side of the table, next to my lawyer, Stafford. There are cameras pointing in all directions, and the technicians scramble to get them focused. Every whisper, every move, every breath will be recorded, because a fortune is at stake. The last will I signed gave little to my children. Josh Stafford prepared it, as always. I shredded it this morning. I'm sitting here to prove to the world that I am of sufficient mental capacity to make a new will. Once it is proved, the disposition of my assets cannot be questioned. Directly across from me are 3 shrinks, one hired by each family. On folded index cards before them, someone has printed their names. Dr. Zadell, Dr. Flo, Dr. Thetian. I study their eyes and faces. Since I am supposed to appear sane, I must make eye contact. They expect me to be somewhat loony, but I'm about to eat them for lunch. Stafford will run the show. When everyone is settled and the cameras are ready, he says, "My name is Josh Stafford, and I'm the attorney for Mr. Troy Phelan, seated here to my right." I take on the shrinks, one at a time, eye to eye, glare to glare, until each blinks or looks away. All three wear dark suits. Zadel and Flo have scraggly beards. Thetian has a bow tie and looks no more than 30. The families were given the right to hire anyone they wanted. Stafford is talking. "The purpose of this meeting is to have Mr. Phelan examined by a panel of psychiatrists to determine his testamentary capacity. Assuming the panel finds him to be of sound mind, then he intends to sign a will which will dispose of his assets upon his death." Stafford taps his pencil on a 1-inch thick will lying before us. I'm sure the cameras zoom in for a close-up, and I'm sure the very sight of the document sends shivers up and down the spines of my children and their mothers scattered throughout my building. They haven't seen the will, nor do they have the right to. A will is a private document revealed only after death. The heirs can only speculate as to what it might contain. My heirs have received hints, little lies I've carefully planted. They've been led to believe that the bulk of my estate will somehow be divided fairly among the children with generous gifts to the ex-wives. They know this. They can feel it. They've been praying fervently for this for weeks, even months. This is life and death for them, because they're all in debt. The will lying before me is supposed to make them rich and stop the bickering. Stafford prepared it, and in conversations with their lawyers he has, with my permission, painted in broad strokes the supposed contents of the will. Each child will receive something in the range of 300 to 500 million, with another 50 million going to each of the three ex-wives. These women were well provided for in the divorces, but that, of course, has been forgotten. Total gifts to the families of approximately $3 billion. After the government rakes off several billion, the rest will go to charity. So, you can see why they're here, shined, groomed, sober for the most part, and eagerly watching the monitors and waiting and hoping that I, the old man, can pull this off. I'm sure they've told their shrinks, "Don't be too hard on the old boy. We want him sane." If everyone is so happy, then why bother with this psychiatric examination? Because I'm gonna screw 'em one last time, and I want to do it right. The shrinks are my idea, but my children and their lawyers are too slow to realize it. Zadel goes first. "Mr. Phelan, can you tell us the date, time, and place?" I feel like a first grader. I drop my chin to my chest like an imbecile and ponder the question long enough to make them ease to the edge of their seats and whisper, "Come on, you crazy old bastard, surely you know what day it is." "Monday," I say softly. "Monday, December 9th, 1996. The place is my office. The time? About 2:30 in the afternoon," I say. I don't wear a watch. "And where is your office?" "McLean, Virginia." Flo leans into his microphone. "Can you state the names and birth dates of your children?" "No. The names, maybe, but not the birth dates." Okay, give us the names. I take my time. It's too early to be sharp. I want them to sweat. Troy Phelan Jr., Rex, Libigail, Mary Ross, Gina, and Ramble. I utter these as if they're painful to even think about. Flo is allowed a follow-up. And there was a seventh child, right? Right. Do you remember his name? Rocky. And what happened to him? He was killed in an auto accident. I sit straight in my wheelchair, head high, eyes darting from one shrink to the next, projecting pure sanity for the cameras. I'm sure my children and my ex-wives are proud of me, watching the monitors in their little groups, squeezing the hands of their current spouses, and smiling at their hungry lawyers, because so far old Troy has handled the preliminaries. My voice may be low and hollow, and I may look like a nut with my white silk robe, shriveled face, and green turban, but I've answered their questions. Come on, old boy, they're pleading. Thetian asks, what is your current physical condition? I've felt better. It's rumored you have a cancerous tumor. Get right to the point, don't you? I thought this was a mental exam, I say, glancing at Stafford, who can't suppress a smile. But the rules allow any question. This is not a courtroom. It is, Thetian says politely, but every question is relevant. I see. Will you answer the question? About what? About the tumor. Sure. It's in my head, the size of a golf ball, growing every day, inoperable, and my doctor says I won't last 3 months. I can almost hear the champagne corks popping below me. The tumor has been confirmed. Are you at this moment under the influence of any medication, drug, or alcohol? No. Do you have in your possession any type of medication to relieve pain? Not yet. Back to Zadel. Mr. Phelan, 3 months ago, Forbes magazine listed your net worth at $8 billion. Is that a close estimate? Since when is Forbes known for its accuracy? So it's not accurate? It's between 11 and 11 and a half, depending on the markets. I say this very slowly, but my words are sharp. My voice carries authority. No one doubts the size of my fortune. Flo decides to pursue the money. Mr. Phelan, can you describe in general the organization of your corporate holdings? I can, yes. Will you? I suppose. I pause and let them sweat. Stafford assured me I do not have to divulge private information here, just give them an overall picture, he said. The Phelan Group is a private corporation which owns 70 different companies, a few of which are publicly traded. How much of the Phelan Group do you own? About 97%. The rest is held by a handful of employees. Thetian joins in the hunt. It didn't take long to focus on the gold. Mr. Phelan, does your company hold an interest in Spin Computer? Yes, I answer slowly, trying to place Spin Computer in my corporate jungle. How much do you own? 80%? And Spin Computer is a public company? That's right. Thetian fiddles with a pile of official-looking documents, and I can see from here that he has the company's annual report and quarterly statements, things any semi-literate college student could obtain. When did you purchase Spin? He asks. About 4 years ago. How much did you pay? $20 a share, a total of $300 million? I want to answer these questions more slowly, but I can't help myself. I stare holes through Thetian, anxious for the next one. And what's it worth now? He asks. Well, it closed yesterday at 43.5, down a point. The stock has split twice since I bought it, so the investment is now worth around 850.
$850 million?
That's correct. The examination is basically over at this point. If my mental capacity can comprehend yesterday's closing stock prices, then my adversaries are certainly satisfied. I can almost see their goofy smiles. I can almost hear their muted hurrahs. Attaboy, Troy, give 'em hell. Zadel wants history. It's an effort to test the bounds of my memory. Mr. Phelan, where were you born? Montclair, New Jersey. When? May 12th, 1918. What was your mother's maiden name? Shaw. When did she die? 2 days before Pearl Harbor. And your father? What about him? When did he die? I don't know. He disappeared when I was a kid. Zadel looks at Flo, who's got questions packed together on a notepad. Flo asks, Who is your youngest daughter? Which family? The first one. That would be Mary Ross. Right? Of course it's right. Where did she go to college? Tulane, in New Orleans. What did she study? Something medieval. Then she married badly like the rest of them. I guess they inherited that talent from me. I can almost see them stiffen and bristle, and I can see the lawyers and the current live-ins and or spouses hide little smiles, because no one can argue the fact that I did indeed marry badly. And I reproduced even more miserably. Flo is suddenly finished for this round. Thetian is enamored with the money. He asks, Do you own a controlling interest in Mountain Calm? Yes. I'm sure it's right there in your stack of paperwork. It's a public company. What was your initial investment? Around 18 a share for 10 million shares. And now it closed yesterday at 21 a share. A swap and a split in the past 6 years, and the holding is now worth about 400 million. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I believe it does. How many public companies do you control?
5. Flo glances at Zadel, and I'm wondering how much longer this will take. I'm suddenly tired. Any more questions? Stafford asks. We're not going to press them, because we want them completely satisfied. Zadel asks, Do you intend to sign a new will today? Yes, that is my intent. Is that the will lying on the table there before you? It is. Does that will give a substantial portion of your assets to your children? It does. Are you prepared to sign the will at this time? I am. Zadel carefully places his pen on the table, folds his hands thoughtfully, and looks at Stafford. In my opinion, Mr. Phelan has sufficient testamentary capacity at this time to dispose of his assets. He pronounces this with great weight, as if my performance had them hanging in limbo. The other two are quick to rush in. I have no doubt as to the soundness of his mind, Flo says to Stafford. He seems incredibly sharp to me. No doubt? Stafford asks. None whatsoever. Dr. Thetian?
Let's not kid ourselves. Mr. Phelan knows exactly what he's doing. His mind is much quicker than ours.
Oh, thank you. That means so much to me. You're a bunch of shrinks struggling to make $100,000 a year. I've made billions, yet you pat me on the head and tell me how smart I am. So it's unanimous, Stafford says. Yes, absolutely. They can't nod their heads fast enough. Stafford slides the will to me and hands me a pen.
I say, this is the last will and testament of Troy L. Phelan, revoking all former wills and codicils. It's 90 pages long, prepared by Stafford and someone in his firm. I understand the concept, but the actual print eludes me. I haven't read it, nor shall I. I flip to the back, scrawl a name no one can read, then place my hands on top of it for the time being. It'll never be seen by the vultures. Meeting's adjourned, Stafford says, and everyone quickly packs. Per my instructions, the three families are hurried from their respective rooms and asked to leave the building. One camera remains focused on me, its images going nowhere but the archives. The lawyers and psychiatrists leave in a rush. I tell Sneed to take a seat at the table. Stafford and one of his partners, Durbin, remain in the room, also seated. When we are alone, I reach under the edge of my robe and produce an envelope, which I open. I remove from it 3 pages of yellow legal paper and place them before me on the table. Only seconds away now, and a faint ripple of fear goes through me. This will take more strength than I've mustered in weeks. Stafford, Durbin, and Sneed stare at the sheets of yellow paper, thoroughly bewildered. "This is my testament," I announce, taking a pen. "A holographic will, every word written by me just a few hours ago, dated today and now signed today." I scrawl my name again. Stafford is too stunned to react. "It revokes all former wills, including the one I signed less than 5 minutes ago." I refold the papers and place them in the envelope. I grit my teeth and remind myself of how badly I want to die. I slide the envelope across the table to Stafford, and at the same instant I rise from my wheelchair. My legs are shaking. My heart is pounding. Just seconds now. Surely I'll be dead before I land. "Hey!" someone shouts. Sneed, I think, but I'm moving away from them. The lame man walks, almost runs, past the row of leather chairs, past one of my portraits, a bad one, commissioned by a wife, past everything to the sliding doors, which are unlocked. I know, because I rehearsed this just hours ago. "Stop!" someone yells, and they're moving behind me. No one has seen me walk in a year. I grab the handle and open the door. The air is bitterly cold. I step barefoot onto the narrow terrace which borders my top floor. Without looking below, I lunge over the railing.
Chapter 3. Sneed was 2 steps behind Mr. Phelan and thought for a second that he might catch him. The shock of seeing the old man not only rise and walk, but also practically sprint to the door froze Sneed. Mr. Phelan hadn't moved that fast in years. Sneed reached the railing just in time to scream in horror, then watched helplessly as Mr. Phelan fell silently, twisting and flailing and growing smaller and smaller until he struck the ground. Sneed clenched the railing and stared in disbelief. Then he began to cry. Josh Stafford arrived on the terrace a step behind Sneed and witnessed most of the fall. It happened so quickly, at least the jump. The fall itself seemed to last for an hour. A man weighing 150 pounds will drop 300 feet in less than 5 seconds. But Stafford later told people the old man floated for an eternity, like a feather whirling in the wind. Tip Durbin got to the railing just behind Stafford and saw only the body's impact on the brick patio between the front entrance and a circular drive. For some reason, Durbin held the envelope, which he had absently picked up during the rush to catch old Troy. It felt a lot heavier as he stood in the frigid air, looking down at a scene from a horror film, watching the first onlookers move cautiously up to the casualty. Troy Phelan's descent did not reach the level of high drama he had dreamed of. Instead of drifting to the earth like an angel, a perfect swan dive with the silk robe trailing behind and landing in death before his terror-stricken families, who he'd imagined would be leaving the building at just the right moment, his fall was witnessed only by a lowly payroll clerk hustling through the parking lot after a very long lunch in a bar. The clerk heard a voice, looked up at the top floor, and watched in horror as a pale, naked body tumbled and flapped with what appeared to be a bedsheet gathered at the neck. It landed on its back, on brick, with the dull thud one would expect from such an impact. The clerk ran to the spot just as a security guard noticed something wrong and bolted from his perch near the front entrance of Phelan Tower. Neither the clerk nor the guard had ever met Mr. Troy Phelan, so neither knew at first upon whose remains they were gazing. The body was bleeding, barefoot, twisted and naked and exposed, with a sheet bunched at the arms. And it was quite dead. Another 30 seconds, and Troy would have had his wish. Because they were stationed in a room on the fifth floor, Tyra and Ramble and Dr. Thetian and their entourage of lawyers were the first to leave the building, and therefore the first to happen upon the suicide. Tyra screamed, not from pain, nor love, nor loss, but from the sheer shock of seeing old Troy splattered on the brick. It was a wretched, piercing scream that was heard clearly by Sneed, Stafford, and Durbin 14 floors up. Ramble thought the scene was rather cool. A child of TV and an addict of video games, he found the gore a magnet. He moved away from his shrieking mother and knelt beside his dead father. The security guard placed a firm hand on his shoulder. "That's Troy Phelan," one of the lawyers said as he hovered above the corpse. "You don't say," said the guard. "Wow," said the clerk. More people ran from the building. Janie, Gina, and Cody, with their shrink Dr. Flo and their lawyers, were next. But there were no screams, no breakdowns. They stuck together in a tight bunch, well away from Tyra and her group, and gawked, like everyone else, at poor Troy. Radios crackled as another guard arrived and took control of the scene. He called for an ambulance. "What good will that do?" asked the payroll clerk, who, by virtue of being the first on the scene, assumed a more important role in the aftermath. "You want to take him away in your car?" asked the guard. Ramble watched the blood fill in the mortar cracks and run in perfect angles down a gentle slope toward a frozen fountain and a flagpole nearby. In the atrium, a packed elevator stopped and opened, and Lillian and the first family and their entourage emerged. Because TJ and Rex had once been allowed offices in the building, they had parked in the rear. The entire group turned left for an exit. Then someone near the front of the building yelled, "Mr. Phelan's jumped!" They switched directions and raced through the front door onto the brick patio near the fountain, where they found him. They wouldn't have to wait for the tumor after all. It took Joshua Stafford a minute or so to recover from the shock and start thinking like a lawyer again. He waited until the third and last family was visible below, then asked Sneed and Durbin to step inside. The camera was still on. Sneed faced it, raised his right hand, and swore to tell the truth. Then, fighting tears, explained what he had just witnessed. Stafford opened the envelope and held the yellow sheets of paper close enough for the camera to see. "Yes, I saw him sign that," Sneed said just seconds ago.
And is that his signature? Stafford asked.
Yes, yes it is.
Did he declare this to be his last will and testament?
He called it his testament. Stafford withdrew the papers before Sneed could read them. He repeated the same testimony with Durbin, then placed himself before the camera and gave his version of events. The camera was turned off, and the three of them rode to the ground to pay their respects to Mr. Phelan. The elevator was packed with Phelan employees, stunned but anxious to have a rare and last glimpse of the old man. The building was emptying. Sneed's quiet sobs were muffled in a corner. Guards had backed the crowd away, leaving Troy alone in his puddle. A siren was approaching, someone took photographs to memorialize the image of his death, then a black blanket was placed over his body. For the families, slight twinges of grief soon overcame the shock of death. They stood with their heads low, their eyes staring sadly at the blanket, organizing their thoughts for the issues to come. It was impossible to look at Troy and not think about the money. Grief for an estranged relative, even a father, cannot stand in the way of a $500 million. For the employees, shock gave way to confusion. Troy was rumored to live up there above them, but very few had ever seen him. He was eccentric, crazy, sick. The rumors covered everything. He didn't like people. There were important vice presidents in the building who saw him once a year. If the company ran so well without him, surely their jobs were secure. For the psychiatrists, Zadel, Flo, and Thetian, the moment was filled with tension. You declare a man to be of sound mind, and minutes later he jumps to his death. Yet even a crazy man can have a lucid interval. That's the legal term they repeated to themselves as they shivered in the crowd. Crazy as a bat, but one clear, lucid interval in the midst of the madness, and a person can execute a valid will. They would stand firm with their opinions. Thank God everything was on tape. Old Troy was sharp and lucid. And for the lawyers, the shock passed quickly, and there was no grief. They stood grim-faced next to their clients and watched the pitiful sight. The fees would be enormous. An ambulance drove onto the bricks and stopped near Troy. Stafford walked under the barricade and whispered something to the guards. Troy was quickly loaded onto a stretcher and taken away. Troy Phelan had moved his corporate headquarters to Northern Virginia 22 years earlier to escape taxation in New York. He spent $40 million on his tower and grounds, money he saved many times over by being domiciled in Virginia. He met Joshua Stafford, a rising D.C. lawyer, in the midst of a nasty lawsuit that Troy lost and Stafford won. Troy admired his style and tenacity, and so he hired him. In the past decade, Stafford had doubled the size of his firm and become rich with the money he earned fighting Troy's battles. In the last years of his life, no one had been closer to Mr. Phelan than Josh Stafford. He and Durbin returned to the conference room on the 14th floor and locked the door. Sneed was sent away with instructions to lie down. With the camera running, Stafford opened the envelope and removed the three sheets of yellow paper. The first sheet was a letter to him from Troy. He spoke to the camera. This letter is dated today, Monday, December 9th, 1996. It is handwritten, addressed to me from Troy Phelan. It has 5 paragraphs. I will read it in full. Dear Josh, I am dead now. These are my instructions, and I want you to follow them closely. Use litigation if you have to, but I want my wishes carried out. First, I want a quick autopsy for reasons that will become important later. Second, there will be no funeral, no service of any type. I want to be cremated, with my ashes scattered from the air over my ranch in Wyoming.
Third, I want my will kept confidential until January 15th, 1997. The law does not require you to immediately produce it. Sit on it for a month. So long, Troy.
Stafford slowly placed the first sheet on the table and carefully picked up the second. He studied it for a moment, then said for the camera,
"This is a one-page document purporting to be the last testament of Troy L. Phelan. I will read it in its entirety." "The last testament of Troy L. Phelan. I, Troy L. Phelan, being of sound and disposing mind and memory, do hereby expressly revoke all former wills and codicils executed by me and dispose of my estate as follows. To my children, Troy Phelan, Jr., Rex Phelan, Libigail Jeter, Mary Ross Jackman, Gina Strong, and Ramble Phelan, I give each a sum of money necessary to pay off all of the debts of each as of today. Any debts incurred after today will not be covered by this gift. If any of these children attempt to contest this will, then this gift shall be nullified as to that child. To my ex-wives, Lillian, Janie, and Tyra, I give nothing. They were adequately provided for in the divorces. The remainder of my estate I give to my daughter, Rachel Lane, born on November 2, 1954, at Catholic Hospital in New Orleans, Louisiana, to a woman named Evelyn Cunningham, now deceased.
Stafford had never heard of these people. He had to catch his breath before plowing ahead.
I appoint my trusted lawyer, Joshua Stafford, as executor of this will, and grant unto him broad discretionary powers in its administration. This document is intended to be a holographic will. Every word has been written by my hand, and I hereby sign it. Signed, December 9th, 1996, 3 p.m., by Troy L. Phelan.
Stafford placed it on the table and blinked his eyes at the camera. He needed a walk around the building, perhaps a blast of frigid air, but he pressed on. He picked up the third sheet and said,
"This is a one-paragraph note addressed to me again. I will read it. Josh, Rachel Lane is a World Tribes missionary on the Brazil-Bolivia border. She works with a remote Indian tribe in a region known as the Pantanal. The nearest town is Corumbá. I couldn't find her. I've had no contact with her in the last 20 years. Signed, Troy Phelan."
Durbin turned the camera off and paced around the table twice as Stafford read the document again and again.
"Did you know he had an illegitimate daughter?"
Stafford was staring absently at a wall.
"No. I drafted 11 wills for Troy, and he never mentioned her. I guess we shouldn't be surprised."
Stafford had declared many times that he had become incapable of being surprised by Troy Phelan. In business and in private, the man was whimsical and chaotic. Stafford had made millions running behind his client, putting out fires. But he was, in fact, stunned. He had just witnessed a rather dramatic suicide, during which a man confined to a wheelchair suddenly sprang forth and ran. Now he was holding a valid will that, in a few hasty paragraphs, transferred one of the world's great fortunes to an unknown heiress without the slightest hint of estate planning. The inheritance taxes would be brutal.
"I need a drink, Tip," he said. "It's a bit early."
They walked next door to Mr. Phelan's office and found everything unlocked. The current secretary and everybody else who worked on the 14th floor were still on the ground. They locked the door behind themselves and hurriedly went through the desk drawers and file cabinets. Troy had expected them to. He would never have left his private spaces unlocked. He knew Josh would step in immediately. In the center drawer of his desk, they found a contract with a crematorium in Alexandria, dated 5 weeks earlier. Under it was a file on World Tribes missions. They gathered what they could carry, then found Sneed and made him lock the office.
"What's in the testament, that last one?" he asked.
He was pale and his eyes were swollen. Mr. Phelan couldn't just die like that without leaving him something, some means to survive on. He'd been a loyal servant for 30 years.
"Can't say," Stafford said. "I'll be back tomorrow to inventory everything. Do not allow anyone in."
"Of course not," Sneed whispered, then began weeping again.
Stafford and Durbin spent half an hour with a cop on a routine call. They showed him where Troy went over the railing, gave him the names of witnesses, described with no detail the last letter and last will. It was a suicide, plain and simple. They promised a copy of the autopsy report, and the cop closed the case before he left the building. They caught up with the corpse at the medical examiner's office and made arrangements for the autopsy.
"Why an autopsy?"
Durbin asked in a whisper as they waited for paperwork.
"To prove there were no drugs, no alcohol, nothing to impair his judgment. He thought of everything."
It was almost 6 before they made it to a bar in the Willard Hotel near the White House, 2 blocks from their office. And it was only after a stiff drink that Stafford managed his first smile.
"He thought of everything, didn't he?" "He's a very cruel man," Durbin said, deep in thought.
The shock was wearing off, but the reality was settling in.
"He was, you mean?"
"No,
he's still here. Troy's still calling the shots. Can you imagine the money those fools will spend in the next month?
It seems a crime not to tell them."
"We can't. We have our orders."
For lawyers whose clients seldom spoke to each other, the meeting was a rare moment of cooperation. The largest ego in the room belonged to Hart Geddes, a brawling litigator who'd represented Rex Phelan for a number of years. Hark had insisted on the meeting not long after he returned to his office on Massachusetts Avenue. He had actually whispered an idea to the attorneys for T.J. and Libigale as they watched the old man being loaded into the ambulance. It was such a good idea that the other lawyers couldn't argue. They arrived, along with Flo, Zadell, and Thetian, at Getty's office after 5. A court reporter and 2 video cameras were waiting. For obvious reasons, the suicide made them nervous. Each psychiatrist was taken separately and quizzed at length about his observations of Mr. Phelan just before he jumped. There was not a scintilla of doubt among the 3 that Mr. Phelan knew precisely what he was doing, that he was of sound mind, and had more than sufficient testamentary capacity. "You don't have to be insane to commit suicide," they emphasized carefully. When the lawyers, all 13 of them, had extracted every opinion possible, Geddes broke up the meeting. It was almost 8 p.m. Chapter 4. According to Forbes, Troy Phelan was the 10th richest man in America. His death was a newsworthy event. The manner he chose made it downright sensational. Outside Lillian's mansion in Falls Church, a cluster of reporters waited on the street for a family spokesman to come forth. They filmed friends and neighbors as they came and went, tossing out banal questions about how the family was doing. Inside, Phelan's 4 eldest children gathered with their spouses and their children to receive condolences. The mood was somber when the guests were present. When the guests were gone, the tone changed dramatically. The presence of Troy's grandchildren, 11 of them, forced T.J., Rex, Libigale, and Mary Ross to at least try and suppress their festive feelings. It was difficult. Fine wine and champagne were served, lots of it, Old Troy wouldn't want them grieving, now would he? The older grandchildren drank more than their parents. A TV set in the den was kept on CNN, and every half hour they would gather for the latest announcement of Troy's dramatic death. A financial correspondent pieced together a 10-minute segment on the vastness of the Phelan fortune, and everyone smiled. Lillian kept a stiff upper lip and did a credible job of being the grieving widow. Tomorrow she would work on the arrangements. Hark Geddes arrived around 10 and explained to the family that he had spoken to Josh Stafford. There would be no funeral, no service of any type, just an autopsy, a cremation, and a scattering of ashes. It was in writing, and Stafford was prepared to do battle in court to protect his client's wishes. Lillian didn't give a damn what they did with Troy, nor did her children, but they had to protest and argue with Geddes. It just wasn't right to send him off with no service. Libigail even managed a small tear and a breaking voice. "I wouldn't fight this," Geddes advised gravely. "Mr. Phelan put it in writing just before his death, and the courts will honor his wishes." They came around quickly. No sense wasting a lot of time and money on legal fees. No sense prolonging the grieving. Why make matters worse? Troy always got what he wanted anyway. And they had learned the hard way not to tangle with Josh Stafford. "We will abide by his wishes," Lillian said, and the other four nodded sadly behind their mother. There was no mention of the will and when they might actually see it, though the question was just below the surface. Best to be properly grim for a few more hours. Then they could get down to business. Since there would be no wake, no funeral or service, perhaps they might meet as early as tomorrow and discuss the estate. "Why the autopsy?" asked Rex. "I have no idea," Geddes answered. "Stafford said it was in writing, but even he is not sure." Geddes left, and they drank some more. The guests stopped coming, so Lillian went to bed. Libigail and Mary Ross left with their families. TJ and Rex went to the billiards room in the basement, where they locked the door and switched to whiskey. At midnight, they were slapping balls around the table, drunk as sailors, celebrating their fabulous new wealth. At 8 a.m., the day after the death of